other British prisoners have been released. And Assange's legal team says that what it appears that the British court and British authorities are doing is basically carving out an exception to make sure that Assange stays behind bars. And this is all the more of a threat to him, given that he also suffers from a chronic lung condition. So we're speaking on a sad occasion and under sad circumstances, but we're going to try to make sense of it with our panel. So we're going to begin just with hearing from everybody at the top, so everybody has a chance to speak. Just speaking for a couple of minutes on your reflections on this one-year anniversary of Assange's abduction from the embassy. Dan Aylesberg, let's begin with you.
If Julian Assange is extradited and prosecuted in the U.S., it will be the first prosecution of a journalist for telling the truth to the American people, ever. A very clear violation of the First Amendment, freedom of the press, and freedom of speech. It will, in fact, be something like the death of the First Amendment or the freedom of press in this country, because the First Amendment was actually passed in large part to prevent precisely such muzzling of a journalist. There have been a number of prosecutions of sources to journalists like Chelsea Manning or myself. I was the very first under President Richard Nixon. President Obama had 9 prosecutions, 3 times as many as the 3 that had preceded him. So it was predictable that Trump would try to exceed that and to go toward journalists. It's of the highest importance, really, to every journalist, certainly in the United States, and I would say to the press in the world, because the press is being oppressed, is being shut down all over the world right now by dictators and so-called populists that are coming in. It's an extremely ominous development. So it's of highest importance that Julian Assange not set this precedent of being the first to shut down free press in the United States.
Thank you, Dan Aylesberg. Marjorie Cohen, Professor Emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and the former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Go ahead.
Yes, the charges against Julian Assange and the possibility that he might be extradited to the United States for trial on those charges poses a mortal threat to freedom of the press. Now, whereas Barack Obama went after whistleblowers in an unprecedented way, including against Chelsea Manning, his administration refrained from indicting Julian Assange because they knew that WikiLeaks did what the New York Times and Der Spiegel and the UK Guardian did as well, publishing documents that was evidence of war crimes. And there were op-eds in the New York Times and other newspapers about how during the Obama administration, about how Julian Assange, WikiLeaks should not be singled out because of this grave threat to freedom of the press. And yet Donald Trump lost no time in going after Julian Assange. And if he is extradited to the United States, as you said, Aaron, he is in grave danger of being tortured the way that Chelsea Manning was tortured by being put in solitary confinement for 11 months. She was made to stand nude during inspection, and it violates the Convention Against Torture, and it violates other laws as well to extradite someone where he would be in danger of being tortured.
Thank you, Marjorie. Chris Hedges.
I want to second everything Marjorie and Dan just said about the press. This is truly ominous. There is a provision in the Espionage Act that has never been implemented, but which they're clearly attempting to use to set a precedent to jail a publisher, not an American citizen. WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based news organization. And at that point, anyone, and I speak as a former reporter for the New York Times who published classified material, can can be charged as well. What we're really seeing here is not only an assault against the ability of the press to shine a light into the inner workings of power, which is why, of course, they've gone after Julian, but just a complete collapse of the rule of law on every level. Under what law did Lenin Moreno, the president of Ecuador, terminate Assange's right of asylum as a political refugee? Under what law did he authorize British police to storm the Ecuadorian embassy, which is sovereign territory of Ecuador, to arrest a person who was a naturalized citizen of Ecuador? Under what law did Theresa May order British police to grab Assange, who has never committed a crime? Under what law does Trump have the right to demand the extradition of Assange, who's not a U.S. citizen, and as I mentioned, whose news organization is not based in the United States? And we've seen that disregard for the rule of law play out in the courtroom in Belmarsh as well.
Thank you, Chris, and look forward to hearing more about that. So let's go to Daniel Ellsberg. Daniel, you are one of the most famous whistleblowers in modern history, leaking the Pentagon Papers. You have also been one of the most vocal advocates and defenders of Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. If you could reflect for us on the year since Assange's arrest, and during that time, we've seen the unveiling of this unprecedented Espionage Act case against Assange. Share with us your thoughts.
You know, the reaction to this pandemic, both in China and the U.S., reveals a tendency of, in starting, as we're told in China, of people afraid to tell even their superiors of the dangers they were facing in their own districts, lest they be condemned, criticized, lose their jobs for not being in control of the health situation in their own province. So it appears that for some people, even Premier Xi was not fully aware of how dangerous this was. And then, of course, sought to downplay it, just as President Trump did exactly the same here. We're now finding, of course, too, that in this country, in the CDC and elsewhere, there were many warnings, including from the intelligence community, that a pandemic was on its way, with all the economic consequences and the deaths coming. So lives and deaths were at stake here in terms of fast warning, with the possibility not just of a small number of lives at the beginning, but that if they were not tested, if they were not isolated right away, the people addressing this knew very well that it would explode out of control, as essentially it has. 2,000 cases here just recently added to the U.S. I'm pointing out that this was a case of successful government secrecy from the public, first from the superiors and then by the superiors to the public. Whistleblowing was extremely in order during that period. It is to the shame of the people who did not risk their jobs and their position, their access, by warning either the people in China or now we know, you know, country after country around the world. If there are honorable exceptions to this, it would be well worth knowing in which country, for example, did people act as they should have to save the lives of their fellow countrymen and other people in the world by announcing promptly. We know, for example, Li Liang, I forgot his name entirely, is a perfect example of this. The first Chinese doctor to feel that he did have a novel coronavirus or a novel virus coming along, meaning a virus to which no one in the world had immunity. So that was the meaning of it, the sinister nature of it. When he announced this, he was forced to recant by his superiors and then told to keep silent. I don't think he did, by the way. And he was one of the very first to die of it. Now, what could illustrate more clearly the ominous, sinister nature of the norm in governments and, in fact, in human groups of all times, of all types, to keep silent to people endangered by something in their awareness, to protect the image or the authority structure or the profit or whatever of some organization or group to which they were member. They may have promised to do that, or they may simply know they would be expelled from that group or that organization. If they gave a warning that the superiors in that group or organization did not want made. And now we heard how many people will die because of the silence of those people. Could they have given that information to WikiLeaks if it were in full operation? Yes. By the way, it wasn't classified. It was simply kept silent. Did it threaten national security? It threatened keeping silent, threatened world security, not national, not just national security. It was the silence that was doing that. Julian Assange set this up in WikiLeaks up in 2006 in order to allow people more easily to break silence and tell truths that were important to others. And I use the word others in the sense of the opposite to us, to we, to the members of some group to which the person belongs, with everybody else in the world being other, outside that group. And unfortunately, what I've learned in 89 years is that humans in general, I'm sorry to say, do not just assign, first of all, most people in the world are other to all humans because they may have a we group, an us group, a membership group of expanding circles, expanding ethnicities, religion, language, nationality, and whatever. But it doesn't extend to the whole species, to the whole world. And there's always, in other words, people outside that broadest group to which people think of ourselves as us, that actually encompasses most people in the world. Here's what I've learned, unfortunately, at my advanced age here now, which is that it's understandable that people who are other than us hold less concern in our minds than our closest family, our relatives, or our closest in-group, or whatever it is. The sad reality I've come to is that there is a circle of others that encompasses most people in the world that have no importance at all for us, no concern. As Noam Chomsky has put it to me, they're like the ants that we make no effort whatever to avoid stepping on as we move along. And here we are in a world which we now see more clearly than ever before is interrelated in such a way that any of us can have impact around the world, basically, in a world of airplane travel. So it's very quick. And other respects, a sick person, a hot spot somewhere can induce heat hotspots all over the world. How much do we care? Our officials do not have the same values even as we do. And they, I'm sorry to say, just don't care. And in that situation, not to expand on that further, a perceived lack of concern for possible victims of a national policy or an organizational policy, like a corporation that is spewing CO2 into the atmosphere from its exploration and burning of fossil fuels. Exxon, I'm talking about Exxon, among others. To know, for instance, as they did, that what they were doing, their business as usual, their business model, was endangering civilization, endangering, in the first instance, all coastal cities in the world, inundation. They knew that as early as the 1950s. That's over half a century ago. They concealed it, they denied it, and what was needed was whistleblowers. What was needed was a way to get that information out to organizations, by the way, and legislatures that did not depend on contributions from the fossil fuel producers. That puts out the US Congress pretty much, certainly the major committees. I believe that WikiLeaks in 2006, very early on, was defying the censorship in China. And thanks to the spectacular revelations of Chelsea Manning and Bradley Manning back in 2010, they've come more and more to focus, not exclusively, on secrecy in the U.S. I would hope that WikiLeaks is ideally suited, actually, to break through the secrecy in China right now that is locking down the internet to a considerable extent, censorship, and which is affecting us as well. What I started out talking about, how many lives could have been saved if Dr. Li had decided when he was shut down to give that information to WikiLeaks for distribution. So there's never been more clear need for this organization and for the whistleblowers who feed into it. And Julian Assange, actually, when he approached me in 2006 to be an early sponsor of it, I couldn't believe that the intelligence community would let him get away with it to any extent. I thought even this might be an intelligence trap for me somehow. I could finally take it seriously. And yet, with the collateral murder, of which we're now almost on the anniversary now of all this time, I realized that was something that the intelligence community and the administration did not want out, and somehow he'd managed to do it. So that was the point at which I came back to Julian Assange and joined arms with him, and have admired and respected his work ever since, and feel that it's of the highest importance that his example not be an example of devastating retaliation, well, which it has been already, but in addition, that it continue to be an example of courage in the face of defiance of the most powerful organizations in humanity, in human history, which are right now in connection with climate, in connection with nuclear weapons, and now in connection with pandemics, of which this is almost surely the first, and not, it's not the first, but the latest, and not the last. In all those circumstances, could not be a clearer demonstration that the different priorities of the corporations and the government will be such as to threaten the very existence of civilization, if not of our species. So the example of the Chelsea Manning and the Ed Snowdens needs to be preserved, Catherine Gunn, Tom Drake, many others, and the example of Julian Assange should inspire other journalists to be aware of the threat facing their own profession and their own values, and act to defy what the administration and the British administration are doing to him, to silence him right now. Thank you. Can't hear you.
Oh, my fault. There we go. Dan, let me ask you briefly, having been indicted under the Espionage Act like Assange, and also having been vilified from the highest levels of government like Assange, I'm wondering if you wanted to comment briefly on the smear campaign that Assange has faced, how he's been so aggressively demonized in public.
Well, when Julian first had a profile done on him by the New York Times, to which he'd given, of course, the documents in he'd offered, let's put it this way, Chelsea, then Bradley Manning, had offered the New York Times and the Washington Post the video or the information from collateral murder. They had shown no interest before she went to WikiLeaks. But the New York Times had then later benefited got great acclaim for the very, very many revelations they made from the material that she had provided WikiLeaks and that WikiLeaks had turned over to the Times, Le Monde, The Guardian, and various other newspapers. So I'm loving you for this reason. He gets a profile in the New York Times, which describes him as not a journalist. He's not one of us. He's other. And let me tell you, I had learned that sources get, in my experience, get no respect whatever from from the people to whom they give the information, with very rare exceptions. Anyway, he was startled by his treatment. It described him not only as scruffy and rubby, but bad smelling, like a homeless person, more or less, because he worked at night. He didn't dress the way they did and so forth. And he was rather startled by this. And when I was with him in London, when he was putting out the Iraq Warlords, which he asked me to join him for in London, I flew across to join him, and I had a long talk with him. And I had to tell him, Julian, you're experiencing exactly what I experienced. Probably the worst article ever written about me, the most shamelessly false article about me, was in the New York Times magazine section, a long article. Every paragraph misleading and wrong, and rather startling to me, because I'd given this to the New York Times initially. Beyond that, it wasn't just that I expected to be protected by them, but I had the illusion that journalists and I, and most journalists that I dealt with, were critical of the war, although that was not true of Abe Rosenthal, the managing editor of the New York Times, which was... Who was in fact supportive of the war at that time. And in retrospect, I give him honestly a lot of credit for going ahead, printing documents, top secret documents from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and others, at a time when, in terms of his journalistic, professional ethics and model, at a time when he himself was actually supportive of the war. I really do give him a lot of credit for that. But with respect to the other journalists, I had the impression that we were on the same team somehow, that what I was giving them, as Julian was giving them with respect to Iraq, a chance, without appearing unobjective or partisan, to put out truths that would be, might shorten the war and solve casualties. I was giving them that, basically. What I had to learn was they didn't regard themselves as being on the same team at all. I really even think that newsmen regard their sources, which are essential to them in their work, the way policemen regard their informers, their informants, their snitches, as criminals, especially people who are giving them classified information, even though no one before me had ever been prosecuted, and there was a reason for that, called the First Amendment, so no one had been prosecuted, but they thought what I was doing was illegal. Right. And they were abetting a crime and not expected to be prosecuted, because up till Julian, no one had been of their ilk and no one before me. But nevertheless, I'm of the criminal class, like Eugene Debs, you might say, but like their informants. And they didn't have any particular respect or any feeling that they owed me anything. And so Julian had to learn that. And of course, Chelsea Manning, the same. We could go into that, but not now. But the same, the first profile of Bradley Manning was equally contemptuous and condescending and ridiculous. So I do think that I've wanted ever since, and we're talking now over half a century, journalists to begin to see sources who have, of course, varying motives, but whistleblowers as a subset of sources, of leakers, are people who really want to right a wrong or to save lives, to give warning to people at risk to their own safety. And they deserve, in my opinion, a kind of respect that they really don't get from journalists. And I would like to see that change on the part of journalists, to begin to see sources as part of the journalistic process.
Thank you, Dan. It's a good segue, because Marjorie Cohen, I mean, there's so many legal aspects of this case we could discuss. They could fill up entire seminars, the charges under the Espionage Act of a media publisher, the U.S. attempt to impose its jurisdiction on Britain with this extradition, how Assange is now fighting for home detention as he faces the threat on his life with the coronavirus pandemic inside the prison. But since we've been talking about collateral murder and the recent anniversary, why don't I ask you to talk about that, is the significance of the releases of Julian Assange via WikiLeaks, and how that factors into his persecution.
Well, the thing that I think people lose sight of, Aaron, is that what WikiLeaks did and what Julian Assange is being targeted for is exposing war crimes. And in fact, the way Dan's revelations of the Pentagon Papers saved lives in Vietnam, so did WikiLeaks' revelations of the Iraq war logs save lives. WikiLeaks published nearly 40,000 field reports on the Iraq war, which contained evidence of war crimes and over 15,000 previously unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians and the systematic murder, torture, rape, and abuse by the Iraqi army and authorities that were ignored by US forces. The way that that saved lives was that Barack Obama was pulling some troops out of Iraq and wanted to conclude an immunity agreement with the Iraqi government so that U.S. forces that remained in Iraq would be immune from civil and criminal prosecution. And yet, after the Iraqi government saw what WikiLeaks had released, which was evidence of the commission of war crimes by U.S. forces in Iraq, they said, no, nothing doing. And that saved lives. Other things that were released by WikiLeaks that amounted to war crimes were the Afghan war logs, which contained 90,000 reports documenting more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had reported. And WikiLeaks also published the Guantanamo files, which were 779 secret reports that revealed the U.S. government's systematic violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture, abusing nearly 800 men and boys ages 14 to 89. Now, the collateral murder video, which we just celebrated the anniversary of, depicts a U.S. Apache attack helicopter killing 12 civilians and wounding two children on the ground in Baghdad in 2007. The helicopter then fired upon and killed the people trying to rescue the wounded. And finally, a U.S. Jeep drove over one of the bodies, cutting the men in half. Those acts constituted three separate war crimes. Chelsea Manning had a duty to report war crimes. She did nothing illegal. And I want to explain that. Section 499 of the Army Field Manual says every violation of the law of war is a war crime, and the law of war is contained in the Geneva Conventions. The first protocol to the Geneva Conventions says that making the civilian population or individual citizens the object of attack is a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, which constitutes a war crime. And the firing on and killing of civilians depicted in the collateral murder video is a war crime because it violates that provision of the Geneva Conventions. The second war crime that the collateral murder video depicts is firing on the rescuers. Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, because there are four Geneva Conventions and they all have the same Article 3 in common, requires that the wounded be collected and cared for. And the first protocol to Geneva says the civilian population shall be permitted, even on their own initiative, to collect and care for the wounded. No one shall be harmed for such humanitarian acts. And yet the firing on rescuers portrayed in the collateral murder video violates those provisions of Geneva. Finally, the Army Field Manual says, and the third is the U.S. Army Jeep driving over the dead body and cutting it in half. Section 27-10 of the Army Field Manual says maltreatment of dead bodies is a war crime, so that when the Army Jeep drove over the dead body, it violated that provision. Now, Chelsea Manning had a duty to report the evidence of war crimes, which she did. And that duty is enshrined in U.S. Army Subject Schedule number 27-1, which says the obligation to report all violations of the law of war is required. There is an obligation. So Manning went to her chain of command and asked them to investigate the collateral murder video, but her superiors refused. The Uniform Code of Military Justice sets forth the duty of a service member to obey lawful orders, but that duty includes the concomitant duty to disobey unlawful orders, and an order not to reveal classified information that contains evidence of war crimes is an unlawful order, and therefore Chelsea Manning had a duty which she fulfilled to reveal the commission of war crimes. And I want to say before I stop my introductory remarks, I just want to say a few words about the extradition of Julian Assange, because the 2003 extradition treaty between the US and the UK says that extradition shall not be granted if the offense for which the extradition is required is a political offense. There's no clear definition of political offense, but it routinely includes treason, sedition, and espionage. And remember, Julian is charged under the Espionage Act and offenses directed against state power. And the revelation of war crimes is a political offense. And finally, I mentioned briefly at the beginning that there is a prohibition against extraditing or sending someone to a country where there's a substantial likelihood they might be tortured. The Convention Against Torture contains a provision, and it's called non-refoulement. And it says if there are substantial grounds to believe that a person would be in danger of being tortured, then that person cannot be sent, in other words, to the United States. Again, Chelsea Manning was tortured. That was documented by the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, and that would likely befall Julian Assange as well. Also, a country has a duty to refuse extradition, that would be the UK, to refuse the US extradition request when it would violate fundamental rights, such as the right to be free from torture and cruel treatment. And finally, the Johannesburg Principles, which of national security, freedom of expression, and access to information, which were adopted by a group of experts in 1995 and have been widely cited by judges, lawyers, journalists, academics, and civil society, says no person may be punished on national security grounds for disclosure of information if the public interest in knowing the information outweighs the harm from the disclosure. And so you can see that number one, Chelsea Manning did nothing wrong when she revealed evidence of war crimes. Number two, Julian Assange did nothing wrong or illegal either when WikiLeaks published evidence of war crimes. And number three, the law forbids the extradition of Julian Assange to the United States.
Let me ask you very quickly. I know the British legal system is different and more complex in some ways, especially, and at least less sympathetic to press freedom than the US is. But let's say the countries were reversed and Britain was trying to bring the exact same case that the US is bringing against Assange in Britain. Let's say that Britain was trying to bring that case against Assange if he were here. Do you think a US court would grant the extradition?
It's impossible to say. It would depend upon the judge. As we know, Trump has not just done a great job in making the Supreme Court into a right-wing court. At least he's on his way to doing that. And I say great job facetiously, but he's also appointed some 190 lifetime federal judges, who many of whom are very young. And so he's making over the judiciary, which is perhaps one of the most dangerous things that he's doing. And so it would depend upon the judge that heard the case. Now, ultimately, it probably would get to the Supreme Court if it was high profile. And then all bets are off. There is a 5-4 conservative majority, right-wing majority. But if Trump is reelected, that could easily turn into a 7-2 majority, right-wing majority for decades to come. So again, it would depend upon the judge and the court.
All right, Chris Hedges, we've touched a bit on how this case is a war on media freedom. And also, as Dan pointed out, that the media has taken part in this war by taking part in the vilification of Assange. Your reflections on this one-year anniversary of Assange's abduction from the Ecuadorian embassy?
Yeah, it's the death of investigative journalism, certainly if Assange is extradited and put on trial in the United States. And it's very clear from the kind of farce of what's happening in a British courtroom, it's kind of a foreshadowing of what would happen into an American court. It's a really ominous moment. And I want to go back to Dan. I spent 15 years at the New York Times. He's right. Most of the people who work at the New York Times are careerists. They know what's good for their career. He's a little too actually generous toward Abe Rosenthal. Abe Rosenthal published the Pentagon Papers because he was well aware that if he didn't, the alternative press, Ramparts and others, would. And the role of the alternative press has always been to shame the mainstream commercial press or elitist publications like the New York Times into doing their job. And that's exactly what happened with WikiLeaks. They published WikiLeaks. And that profile was probably of Assange, a very accurate depiction of how most people in the newsroom, certainly the hierarchy of the New York Times, viewed him. But they realized that not to publish the information that WikiLeaks had disclosed would expose them as kind of a craven handmaiden of power. But then, of course, they did what they did to Dan, what they did to Chelsea, and they crucified Assange. They angered to a certain extent the establishment by publishing that material. But then they did what their role is as a liberal organization, and that is to defame, insult, and carry out prolonged character assassination against figures that rose up against the establishment. That's how liberal institutions, this is what Chomsky has pointed out many times, that is the role of liberal institutions. They are used to ameliorate, to a certain extent, the system itself, to perhaps critique the excesses of the system, but not to question the virtues and the goodness of the system. And so when you have figures like Dan, like Chelsea, like Julian, like Snowden, that rip back the veil and expose the mendaciousness and criminal activity on the part of the power elite, the role of the liberal establishment is why it's allowed to exist in a capitalist democracy, is to use, to posit themselves as kind of the moral arbiter and to destroy, destroy and turn into pariahs those figures that have spoken a truth about power that those in power don't want heard. I started as a journalist in El Salvador in the early 1980s. I've had a long career, and I've watched how American journalism has atrophied and to a certain extent died. And it's been quite disturbing. As I mentioned earlier, I published classified material myself in the New York Times, but now it's virtually impossible because, as Dan correctly pointed out, in order for a journalist to expose the inner workings of power, they need someone on the inside who has the moral courage to stand up and provide that information to the public. That's become impossible to do with wholesale surveillance. The Obama administration, Obama's assault on civil liberties, by the way, outdid even those by George W. Bush. The constant use of the Espionage Act against all sorts of people, Kiriakou and Binney and Snowden, of course, and others who attempted to show the public what power was doing, had the effect, coupled with, of course, now the most sophisticated security and surveillance apparatus in human history, to shut everything down. It's why Snowden had to flee the country, because he knew he would be instantly found out. The government has all of our electronic communications, including, of course, our phone records, courtesy of the major phone companies. There's no way out. And so the last readout of those who can tell us what's happening within the systems of power are actually hackers. And that's That is not the fault of the hackers. It's the fault of the state. So when Jeremy Hammond, I went to his trial, he's in jail for 10 years. When I sued Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, and we actually won in Southern District Court of New York, and then the Obama administration appealed it. But much of our evidence came from what Hammond had leaked between a private security firm, Stratfor, and government officials who were actively in exchanges of emails to tie nonviolent dissident groups to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda or others, so they could use terrorism laws against them. And these terrorism laws, of course, are now being used against figures like Assange. I think it's pretty clear from what's happened in the British courtroom that the trial is fixed. This judge is a piece of work. We've seen, for instance, the U.S. prosecutors never objected to Assange sitting with his lawyers. But the judge unilaterally decided that Assange had to remain in this kind of glass cage. Because of the coronavirus and everything else, the U.S. prosecutors actually didn't object to a postponement of the trial. And yet the judge decided that it had to go ahead anyway. The U.S. prosecutors never objected when the defense raised objections about Assange being strip searched and about having all of his legal material confiscated from him so he couldn't prepare. And yet the judge saying that this was beyond her ability to control kept those strip searches, which are just a form of humiliation, and the confiscation of his material in place. She was actually criticized by jurists around the world for that after that decision. And then, of course, as Marjorie pointed out, it's very clear under the 2003 Extradition Act that Assange should not be extradited at all. And she has at least on three occasions dismissed that very black and white legal position to uphold the right of the U.S. government to extradite Assange. So we are seeing a much, as the ability of the oppressed to hold power in check deteriorates, we're seeing a much more naked and overt defiance of the rule of law, because of course there are no constraints. There are no judicial constraints. There are no constraints in terms of a press being able to hold power accountable. And I think all of this represents a kind of very steady and frightening march towards a kind of corporate totalitarianism. And if you want to know what that looks like, you can kind of see our future and what's happened to the Uyghurs in China.
So we have time for some viewer questions. And if you have them, you can type them in the comment section on whatever platform you're watching this on. I'm going to put the first viewer question to you, Chris. It's from Stephen Rode, and he asks, in the midst of COVID-19 and the regular noise of what passes for news in the U.S. today, how do people of conscience effectively express their opposition to the prosecution of Julian Assange? Do we have any allies in Congress?
You don't have any allies in Congress that I know of. Not through the political process, and not by voting for Joe Biden. I think that the only mechanism, I've said this for a long time, the only mechanism we have left to pit power against power is to step out of the arena of traditional political activity and begin to do the kinds of things that Extinction Rebellion has done in terms of shutting down London over the climate emergency, what was done by indigenous communities at Standing Rock, what was done by Occupy Wall Street, what was done by the Quebec student movement. We have seen uprisings fairly recently, Lebanon, Chile, Hong Kong, That's the only mechanism left by which we can protect whatever remnants there are of our open society. Because whether it's Biden or whether it's Trump, they're utterly united on the lynching of Assange and the shutting down of any mechanism by which the crimes of empire, not just the crimes of empire, remember Assange leaked the Podesta emails and exposed the whole corruption of the Hillary Clinton campaign, including the fact that the Clinton campaign worked actively to make sure Trump was the nominee because they foolishly thought he was the weakest candidate and the easiest to beat. And so, you know, on most issues, all major issues, really, there's no real difference between the Democratic and Republican parties. And we see that in the effort to go after Assange, including that charming quote by Hillary Clinton that somebody should take Assange out with a militarized drone.
Excuse me, can I make one comment on that? I believe that Senator Bernie Sanders did say during the campaign that he would not prosecute whistleblowers under the Espionage Act, and he would relieve them. Correct me if I'm wrong, if anybody knows I'm wrong, but I think he did say that. Another senator who has not been covering himself with virtue and glory lately, he's been a toady to Trump lately, but Rand Paul, I think, has in fact spoken out in favor of Assange, and I think both he and his father were the only people I knew in Congress who had said anything favorable about me that I can remember, so that gives me a little warm feeling. But I think that Sanders is in a position right now, actually, to reiterate that point in the Senate and to bring some other senators with him.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, that there were Bernie, along with Elizabeth Warren and along with Senator Ron Wyden, did criticize the indictment. That is correct.
Marjorie Cohen, somebody asked in the comments, is there any role for international law here? We've seen the UN Special Rapporteur on torture try to intervene and raise his voice and other legal experts, but is there any role for the United Nations here or some other type of international law body to intervene in Assange's case?
Yes, well, first of all, let me say that the judge who is presiding over Julian Assange's hearing has apparently prejudged the whole issue of extradition, because when Julian's lawyers asked for him to have bail because he was in danger of getting the coronavirus, he's exercising in a small area with 40 people in close quarters for an hour a day, and he has a pre-existing pulmonary very, very serious respiratory condition, and so he's very vulnerable to the virus. She turned down that motion for bail. He hasn't seen his lawyers for 3 weeks, but when she turned it down, she said he's a flight risk and there is a high risk of extradition, which sounds to me like she's tipping her hand. Now, The extradition hearing is going to continue in May. It started in February. It's going to continue in May. It could go into June or July. If she grants Trump's motion to extradite Julian Assange to the United States, then the case will go through the appeals process in the UK and ultimately to the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights can make a ruling that would overturn what the British court did. So that's one avenue. That's a regional court, the European Court of Human Rights. There also could be a complaint filed with the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion. It wouldn't be a contentious jurisdiction because the United States won't submit to it, but the International Court of Justice is the world court. It's the judicial arm of the UN system. And the Assange's lawyers could ask for an advisory opinion, although it has to come through an organ of the UN. It could come from any of the countries or the agencies in the countries in the General Assembly, which is the democratic part of the UN, or any of the UN agencies, asking the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion about whether the extradition of Julian Assange violates international law. And as I explained, it clearly does.
Dan Ellsberg, if Assange were to be extradited to the U.S., what type of fate do you think he awaits, and how do you think people should fight his extradition?
You're saying if he is extradited, is that he is extradited and tried over here, I think. So fighting the extradition would be too late at that point. We're fighting extradition right now, I think, which is when it has to be fought. But if he were extradited, I would expect that under the current state of the courts, which Marjorie has described both in the Supreme Court and the lower levels, that he would be convicted. And for a while, I was kind of proud that with my 12 felony counts adding up to 115 years, of possible prison, I was a little proud of the fact that none of the conspiracies under Watergate, which involved four or five people at a time, their sentences ever added up to mine. I like that exceptionalism. Well, his offenses now, indictments, add up to 175, and I yield to him now the fate he would face. Of course, for either of us, it would be a life sentence, even with good behavior, if either of us show good behavior in a prison environment. So right now, of course, he is facing death from COVID-19 in a situation in which is, you know, in general, all the prisoners are now suddenly facing, for whatever crime they're committed or are charged with, they are now facing a possible death effect. And he, in particular, I have little doubt, by the way, that the authorities in this country, I'm talking in the executive branch, would be happy to see Julian Assange off their hands by the coronavirus 19. And they wouldn't have to face the constitutional issues at all. But I'm afraid that if he did survive that and was brought here, he would not only be convicted for essentially a life sentence, but that he would serve that sentence, I believe, in isolation, except for the half hour a day that they could put him in with enough other people to finish him off, perhaps, from COVID, if that persists. I presume perhaps that won't persist forever. But he will be, I think, in the 23 and a half hours a day of isolation that Chelsea Manning was in for 10 and a half months in Quantico, the brig at Quantico, Quantico being where I went through basic school and OCs in the Marine Corps, and where I got arrested, as a matter of fact, protesting then Bradley Manning's arrest. And it was only the public protest in general that got her out of that situation into a general prison population, where she stayed for the next 7 years. So for 10 and a half months, she was in isolation. I think that would be true essentially forever for Julian, on the pretext that he still perhaps had secrets to give. It was on that to others, and they couldn't afford that risk. That's how Mordecai Vanunu in Israel was kept in isolation in a very small cell for, I believe, something like 11 years of, as I recall, a 17-year sentence before he was out for revealing that Israel was a nuclear state, an undeclared nuclear state, Mordecai Vanunu. So in other words, I think that's the fate that would be awaiting him here.
Chris Hedges, for people who are frustrated by the vilification of Julian Assange and the lack of political support that he has, even from progressives in Congress that we've talked about, I wonder if you could offer us some words on how to understand that and how to push back on it.
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, that's always been the role of the liberal establishment. That's why in a capitalist democracy you tolerate them. Immediately when you challenge the motives, the virtues, the intentions of the power elite, the liberal establishment is the mechanism that is used to essentially push you outside the circle. I speak as somebody who's been pushed outside the circle. So, you know, the whole Matt Taibbi wrote a good book, Hate Inc., on the media. And on one side of the cover is Rachel Maddow and the other is Sean Hannity. And they both function the same nefarious purpose, which is to discredit those people who seriously examine or challenge the centers of power, and to redirect frustrations and anger of whatever their audience is towards each other. So, I mean, that's why Maddow spends 2 years slogging the whole Russiagate, and Aaron, you've done very good work on this, fantasy, because it diverts attention from the catastrophic betrayal by the Democratic Party elite of working men and women in this country and their complicity in creating these levels of social inequality. Not only that, of course, but the whole evisceration of basic civil liberties, due process, habeas corpus, you know, the explosion of mass incarceration, which was the architects of this were Biden and Clinton. And so, I mean, how do you deal with the frustration of it? I mean, I think my biggest frustration is how effective that propaganda often is. You know, we just went through this at Truth Dig, which is shut down. We went on strike when the publisher attempted to fire the founding editor, Robert Scheer, one of America's great journalists, because Scheer wasn't buying the Russiagate garbage and kept calling it out. He wasn't buying the red baiting of Bernie Sanders. And let's be clear, the New York Times was vicious towards Sanders. I have my own critique of Sanders, but they were vicious. And that was, you know, them kind of exposing or playing the role that they're designed to play. And so, you know, that challenge by Scheer and made the publisher, who comes from these rich liberal circles, uncomfortable. She attempted to take over the site. We all went on strike and now we all got fired. But it's a problem. I mean, because the space within America media has shrunk so much that those of us who remain fierce critics of neoliberalism and corporate capitalism and imperialism and the Democratic Party, I would add, have not only been pushed to the margins of the internet, but we've now seen Google, Facebook, Twitter carry out brutal algorithms. I mean, I have a chart of it. So impressions. So if you typed in my name and imperialism, or if you typed in imperialism and I had written an article on imperialism, it would have come up with other articles. That's called an impression. Now my won't come up. By the way, Julian Assange has been completely erased. So they use these algorithms because I think in the end, they don't have a counter argument. And because they don't have a counter argument, nobody's buying the idiocy of neoliberalism anymore as a way to spread wealth. It's of course now been exposed as a mechanism by which we consolidate wealth and power in the hands of a global oligarchic elite. And so because they don't have because their own credibility has been shredded, they're using much more brutal mechanisms to retain control and exposing their authoritarian or even totalitarian tendencies. And this gets right back to what's happening to Assange and the evisceration, the mockery of the rule of law on so many levels by Sweden, by Ecuador, by the United States, by Great Britain, in order to take a person who is not an American citizen, who headed a news organization that was never based in the United States under the Espionage Act. I mean, this is insane. And extradite him to the United States. But it's all the pretense of the rule of law. It's really, you know, we're moving very quickly to kind of 1937 Stalinist show trials. And it's, you know, this is just one more piece of that puzzle.
Marjorie Cohen, from where you sit inside the legal community, is there an awareness of what is happening to the law in Assange's case in the way that Chris is talking about, this warping of the law in various countries, you know, Sweden, Britain, and the US? Is there an awareness about it and any kind of protest?
I think very little, unfortunately, Aaron. When people like Chris and I write articles, I write for Truth Out, not Truth Dig, and criticize a lot of the things that Chris criticizes, although I think Donald Trump is the greatest danger facing the world at the moment, and we have to get rid of him by any means necessary, including voting for Joe Biden, who is a terrible candidate, but I think not nowhere near as dangerous as Donald Trump, and particularly when we're talking about the courts as a bottom line. But when I write articles about Assange and speak about Assange and other lawyers from the National Lawyers Guild, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, which I also work with, talk about it, many times it appears that people, particularly in the legal community, are hearing it for the first time. And there is a prejudice against Julian Assange for the, as Chris mentioned, the release of Podesta's emails, although WikiLeaks was not the first to do that. It was a Freedom of Information Act request by another organization. And so I think there's a lot of misinformation about Julian Assange, about the allegations, which were never memorialized into charges of sexual assault in Sweden. Those charges were dropped. But I think there are a lot of myths floating around out there about what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have actually done, and unfortunately, far too little understanding and knowledge of the incredible service that WikiLeaks did for us and for the world in exposing the war crimes that Chelsea Manning so heroically released.
All right, so we're going to go to some closing remarks if anybody has them. Before we do, I want to give a shout out to someone in case they're watching. We have in New York City the weekly vigils for Julian Assange. It'll be going on for a long time. And they're organized by a group called the Big Apple Coffee Party. And one of their organizers, Chuck Zlatkin, contracted the coronavirus, and he is now recovering. So in case, Chuck, you're watching, I just want to wish you a speedy recovery and thank you for all that you're doing. And I'm glad to hear that you are doing well. So, if anybody has any closing remarks, let's hear them now.
I'd like to say to this audience, which I hope is very varied, is broad, I hope. I'm sure it's broad enough to include people who do not like what they've heard of Julian Assange, who do not agree with him. I want to make it clear that you don't have to agree with Julian Assange's politics as they perceived, or to like him, as I do, actually, to feel this is a crucial case, as Chris and Marjorie and I have all argued that it is. For example, I could say right now that if a couple of journalists that I do not like and respect in the slightest, I'll mention Stephen Bannon of Breitbart News, formerly in the White House, or if Sean Hannity were exactly, who is terrible, we're in exactly the same position as Julian Assange right now in Britain for the same charges and everything else, I believe I would be as effortful and dedicated to avoiding their extradition and or conviction on these charges as I am for Julian. A lot of the Julian Assange in recent years, especially in 2016, are very controversial and have earned him very great opposition by many people who I would say are otherwise respectable and whom I agree with. And even on that point, I don't agree with his judgment during that period entirely, and I'll explain exactly why. But that doesn't affect, for one thing, even though I see him as somebody who had very different judgment from me on a point I wanted to find in a moment here, I gave him a lot of leeway in my own mind as somebody who had been in one room for 7 years, and I'm not going to judge the judgment or evaluate the judgment of a friend of mine who, as Julian had admitted several times, on being in one room for 7 years. Now, what is that question? By the way, I want to make clear, I am honored to be on this program with two heroes of mine, Marjorie Cohn and Chris Hedges. And I think they've been absolutely exemplary in the way the lives they've been living for years now and what they've been telling the public. Again, to support Julian Assange, as we all do in this position, we don't have to agree with each other any more than Julian. On this very one critical point, I share, I believe, every criticism of the Democratic Party and of Joe Biden and of Barack Obama that I've ever heard from the left and from Chris Hedges specifically and others. I share them. I have no disagreement. I believed in 2016, not knowing Trump as well as we all do now, that bad as the Democratic Party was in that situation, and Hillary Clinton, let me add her, I think I share every criticism, that Donald Trump looked much worse to me. In other words, I've seen for a long time two bad parties in the United States. One, I would say, much worse than the others, than the other. In this, I think I agree with my hero, Chris, I disagree with my hero, Chris Hedges, on this point. Let's say with Ralph Nader's point and many others, that they really are Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and that there is no significant difference between them. I disagree with that. And I agree with what Marjorie said now. I think now that we have seen 3 years of Trump, it's no longer an ambiguous figure here. He is, I think, the most dangerous politician because of his position in charge of and the head of the United States, that you could say that humanity has ever seen in the sense of the climate problem alone. I think 4 more years of Donald Trump will do irreparable damage beyond what we've already condemned the world to in by the fossil fuel industries and their lies and their secrecy and their development and their their effect on the atmosphere here. 4 more years of Trump doing everything he can, as far as I can see, to hasten catastrophic climate change must go. And if I'll disagree only with Marjorie, by any means necessary, I'm sure she does not mean violent means any more than I do. Every nonviolent, truthful means necessary, he must go. And that absolutely does mean at this point, with Bernie Sanders having dropped, suspended his campaign, that does mean supporting Biden, telling other people, especially in swing states, to support him, and not only to vote for him, but to encourage other people to vote for him and not to fail to vote, not to vote for a third party, however meritorious that party is. I suspect, Chris, I would expect, disagrees with me strongly on this point. But that's, and Marjorie, I suspect, does not. But that makes no difference. I come back to the point that Julian Assange, and I think he's been dealt badly with by the movies dealing with him, entirely, not only by the New York Times. He's been very badly portrayed, very unfairly. But as I do say to people who say, how can you be a friend to Julian Assange, especially after 2016, I say, Julian Assange is not a perfect person, unlike you and me. And that's what it comes down to. It's essential, I think, to support Julian Assange in this situation. I'm happy to do it with what I know of him. I do like him. I do regard him as a friend, but many people do not. And I call on them to recognize the danger here that Chris Hedges has so, and Marjorie, whom I'd love to have as a defense lawyer, and I'm sure I'll need one if I survive COVID-19. Julie, I'm going to call on you, Marjorie, that was a terrific job, and Chris, for the reason they've given here. This is a worldwide, should be a worldwide concern, I would say, right now, the situation of Julian Assange. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Marjorie Cohen, any closing remarks?
Yes, just briefly, I underscore what Dan says, and I would go even further. And just Exhibit A about Donald Trump's the danger he poses to the world is the way he has handled the plague. I call it the plague because somehow that makes it sound less frightening. I don't know why, but the way he's handled it, in denial for 2 months. And I consider Donald Trump responsible for innumerable numbers of deaths and people who have become sick by that virus, and what he is doing in his daily briefings and trying to rush us back into opening the economy again is serving his capitalist masters, and doing it in the most repulsive, disgusting way when people's lives are in danger. First in denial for at least 2 months about the severity of it, and now trying to paper over and deny as well the severity of what people are facing. This isn't just the first pandemic. This is the worst pandemic. I don't think there's ever been an incident. There certainly have been wars that have impacted many, many countries, but there has never been an event that has impacted every single person on Earth. I mean, this is something we have never seen. And who knows how many people will die, how many people will get ill, and when it will ever end. And the way that Donald Trump has handled it, I think, his states' rights theory that the states should handle it, the federal government is not going to help out, is extremely dangerous. But I just want to end by saying that I'm very, very happy to announce that we have formed a Julian Assange Civil Liberties Defense Committee. And I'm also very pleased to report that Dan Ellsberg, along with Alice Walker, are the co-chairs of this new committee. And I'm just so honored and delighted to be on this panel with Dan and Chris as well, whose work I have admired for many, many years. And his courage and his willingness to tell it the way it is, tell it like it is, when the corporate media is doing precisely the opposite. So I really appreciate being part of this panel, and I urge people to keep an eye open for the Julian Assange Civil Liberties Defense Committee, which is going to be holding webinars all over the country, doing educational programs, distributing information about Julian's case so that people who don't really know the details will know what is at stake. And this is not over yet. It's going to go on for a number of months until the extradition issue is ultimately resolved. And in the meantime, we have to do everything we can to get Julian released and to prevent his extradition to the United States, which would be devastating to Julian Assange and devastating to the First Amendment.
Thank you, Marjorie. Chris Hedges, there's a lot you could respond to there because we've sagged a little into the merits of lesser evil voting, but I'm going to ask you to hold off on that and keep your final remarks focused on Julian Assange.
Yeah, I just want to second, my deep admiration for both Dan and Marjorie. I mean, these are two of the moral titans and have demonstrated this decade after decade in really defense of the open society and defense of those who have stood up and often been ostracized and attacked and vilified the way Julian has. We have to be clear that Julian is being persecuted not for his vices, but for his virtues. I've spent many hours with him in the embassy. Like Dan, I also consider him a friend. I like him, but that's irrelevant. I was strongly supportive of Jeremy Hammond, indeed visited him in jail. Jeremy is a charter member of the Black Bloc. I detest the Black Bloc. In fact, the Black Bloc detests me, but that didn't matter. He has every right to his position And what he did was immensely courageous and important. And I stood by him and stand by him, as I do Julian. Like Dan, yes, there are things, political positions that Julian espouses, which I don't, but that is, again, utterly irrelevant. What I see now is this frightening kind of constriction of what freedom we have left, often a freedom that exists only in name. When your government watches you 24 hours a day, you can't use the word liberty. That is the relationship of a master and a slave. And this very efficient monitoring by the centers of power, and of course we all carry around tracking devices to make it even easier for them, will be used. The Chinese are just one step ahead of us, although there's all sorts of AI, American AI companies assisting them to create a very frightening Orwellian kind of dystopia. And that's why this battle over Julian is so crucial. For those of us who are pushing back against this tsunami of state repression, there's a wonderful memoir by Joseph Roth's partner, written in 1937, Roth being the great Austrian journalist who foresaw the rise of fascism and called them out from the 20s onward. He's now blacklisted. He can't publish anymore. Eventually, he'll have to, the day Hitler assumed power, he actually got on a train out of Berlin and went to France, where he died in poverty. But in this memoir, so you have all these intellectuals and journalists and artists and communists and Jews who in the walls are closing in. And there's a moment where Roth, who's a character in the novel, is quoted as saying, you know, I was a mouse squeaking against an avalanche, but squeak we must. And I think in the end, and I think Marjorie's life is an example of this. I think Dan's life is an example of this. We must do what we must do, not because it's practical or not because we will even succeed, but because it's right. And that's what Julian did. What Julian did was right, and he's paying for it. And we have to begin to stand up simply because it's a moral imperative. There's a line I steal from Sartre. I don't fight fascists because I'll win. I fight fascists because they are fascists.
Mm. Well, let me say on behalf of, I think, everybody watching today, it is such an honor to be here with this panel. And we're so grateful you took the time to share with us your insight. Daniel Ellsberg, Marjorie Cohen, and Chris Hedges. I want to also thank Nathan Fuller and the Courage Foundation for putting this on. And to get all the latest about Julian Assange's case and to join his defense, the fight for his freedom, you can go to defend.wikileaks.org. Again, defend.wikileaks.org. Thank you to everybody for tuning in today. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us. And stay tuned for more from the Courage Foundation and WikiLeaks about how we can free Julian Assange. So thanks, everybody.
Are we off?
We are off.
Chris, I'm sorry. I missed the name. Roth, who is this person you were describing and what was the book? I'd love to get that.
Oh, Joseph Roth. He wrote Radetzky March. He wrote Savoy Hotel. The book